This is Old Building Bridges, your community and labor report special, Running the Gauntlet, Union Organizing in the USA Today. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
While polls show nationwide support for unions, the percentage of unionized workers in the labor force declines each year. In this one-hour Building Bridges special, we'll talk with workers who have tried to form unions only to run the gauntlet of unfair labor practices, including firings. Even when the workers are successful, businesses frequently relocate or stall endlessly before a first contract.
Later on Building Bridges, to ask AFL-CIO Director of Organizing, Stuart Acoff, what needs to be done to change labor law and to build a movement to organize the unorganized.
But first, we go to a recent New Jersey Congressional Forum on the Employee Free Choice Act, a labor initiative to reform the ineffective labor laws that permit wholesale violations of worker rights to organize. You'll hear from a number of workers and members of Congress. The forum was chaired by Congressmember Rob Andrews.
Forum on the Employee Free Choice Act. I am Congressman Rob Andrews from the 1st District of New Jersey. Ms. Muller is a registered nurse at Virtue West Jersey Hospital in Voorhees. She's with Janesso. Welcome.
I've been a registered nurse at Virtua for 27 years. I'm married. I have one daughter who's in college. She's hoping to become a registered nurse, a unionized registered nurse, as I am. In 1996, my coworkers and I decided to form a union. The hospital was eliminating positions, and this was causing concern for the safety of our patients and for the quality of care that our patients were receiving. They increased our health care premiums 2 years running, took away extra pay, and had not given us a raise for 3 years. When we began organizing, the hospital started an anti-union campaign. They hired a union-busting firm, and we received volumes of anti-union letters and leaflets. Nurses were pulled off patient care areas during work time to attend mandatory anti-union meetings, and several nurses were fired. Despite the hospital's campaign of intimidation, we won our election in April of 1996. Unfortunately, the hospital refused to accept our decision and challenged the election. The legal challenges took over 2 years to resolve and went all the way to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. The Third Circuit Court of Appeals denied the hospital's objections and certified the results of the election. Still, despite the court's ruling, the hospital continued to obstruct our rights by refusing to bargain in good faith. The NLRB issued complaints against the hospital, but this still did not force them to the table. What is their penalty for their blatant disregard for the law? They put up a letter in the back hallway on a bulletin board and says they were bad. Is that their penalty? They must be held accountable for their actions, and the Employee Free Choice Act can do this. We finally began negotiations in October of 1998. After numerous ineffective negotiation sessions, we were eventually forced to authorize a strike. Finally, in June of 2000, just a little over 4 years after we voted the union in, we were finally able to negotiate our first contract. We won raises, benefits, but most importantly, a voice in our work rules. Even after our four-year struggle, the hospital is still blocking the efforts of other workers at the hospital to form a union. Last month, the NLRB ruled against our paramedics, throwing out their ballots and negating their election. In this day and age, and in this country, it is frustrating and offensive that workers like me have to face such harassment and intimidation when exercising their legally protected rights. No one should endure threats to their livelihood, and no one should have to wait 4 years to have their choice recognized. Congressman, just imagine not being able to take office for 4 years because your opponent challenged the results of your election. You would not stand for it, and neither should we. I, along with my coworkers, hope you will support workers struggling to form unions in New Jersey and around the country and fight in Congress for a more fair process. Thank you.
Carol, thank you very much. We really would not want that long transition period, I assure you. The third witness is Mr. Paul Patterson, who is a support specialist at St. John's Community Services in Hamilton, New Jersey, member of CWA Local 1037. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Congressman. Hi, my name is Paul Patterson. I'm 61 years old. I've been employed by St. John's Community Services for approximately 4 years. The last couple of years, they've got progressively worse on how they've handled their employees to the point where I felt I had to get involved in an organizing campaign. reasons being unfair disciplinary actions, safety issues, and care of our actual consumers that they were being paid for by the federal and state money. We started organizing in November. We filed the cards in December, held the elections in January. During this period of time, the company ran many anti-union meetings, one-on-one campaigns, lunches, dinners, and so forth. On January 8th, we held a meeting at the home which I worked in, which was the Academy Group home, and I challenged several of the statements that were made by our director of development, who was third in command for the company. After the meeting, he told me he would like to see me outside, at which time I went out, had a discussion with him. His comments to me were, "We all make choices. You made the wrong choice. You chose to back the union. You sealed your fate with St. John's." I told him that I thought it was a point where some of the wrongdoings had to be straightened out, and I was going to hold with my move. On January 12th, the company held a very large meeting. It was a breakfast, lunch, and dinner, which was very good food. We had lobster, steak, some of the best breakfast foods you could. This was after many statements that they had no money to go union. The president of the company, Tom Wiles, brought in a union anti-organizing campaign group. After he presented his statements, I requested to have 5 minutes to dispute some of the comments he had made. The president, in front of everybody there, simply said to me, "This is my meeting. I pay for your food. Shut up." At that point, I said, "Yes, sir. You signed my paycheck." A week later, we had the elections. We won the election. They challenged the results of the election all the way up through D.C. To this date, they still have refused to negotiate a contract. I was elected as part of the bargaining unit. Since then, it's been all downhill for me. When I started with the organizing campaign, I was working 40-plus hours, making fairly good money. I'm currently working 15 hours a week, have no contact with my fellow employees. I've been removed from that home. I work with one individual in an apartment complex. I'm not allowed in the home unless I'm requested to be there for company business. Basically, they're doing everything they can to stop the negotiations. We had set dates for negotiation. They replaced the lawyer they had with another lawyer, and we're currently scheduled until their next move, where I'm sure they'll come up with another reason why not to sit down at the table. I'd like to thank this group for all your help in trying to rectify some of these problems from management. I'd also like to say that St. John's is my first job in 40 years where I haven't been management, and they managed to convert me to a union employee. Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Patterson, I assure you, your voice may have been silenced in the workplace, but it's heard loud and clear here. Ms. Acosta is a warehouse worker for H&M Company in Secaucus. She's a member of Unite Here.
Mi nombre es Ana María Acosta. Yo he trabajado en el centro de distribución de H&M en Secaucus, New Jersey, por los últimos 4 años. Hace 2 años, mis compañeros de trabajo y yo decidimos formar una unión con Unite Here.
My name is Ana Maria Costa. I've been working at the distribution center at H&M in Secaucus, New Jersey for the last 4 years. 2 years ago, my coworkers and I decided to form a union with Unite Here. We did this to gain better benefits, health insurance, to increase our wages, and to have a voice in our working conditions. We were very concerned about the health and safety issues in our plant, especially since many of my coworkers had been injured on the job. Even though H&M is a Swedish company that has unions in Europe,
que tratan a sus trabajadores con dignidad y respeto. Sin embargo,
and they treat their workers there with dignity and respect. Nevertheless, they did not treat us with that same dignity and respect. When the company realized that we were trying to form a union, they responded strongly with harassment, threats, and intimidation. The company also had anti-union meetings. They also showed anti-union videos, and they tried to dissuade us from joining a union. All of this was mandatory, and we were forced to listen to this. Many of my coworkers had already used the NLRB process of elections with their previous employers. Because of their bad experiences, we decided to avoid this proceeding.
Nosotros mismos decidimos lograr el reconocimiento por medio de un conteo de tarjetas. En agosto del 2003, nosotros independientemente tuvimos un conteo.
We decided we wanted recognition by way of a card check agreement. In August 2003, we independently held a card check where we had a priest verify that we had a majority of workers sign union authorization cards. Nevertheless, the company did not recognize our decision, and they continue to harass us with retaliation, especially the union supporters. When I began to openly support the union, I wore buttons and a union t-shirt. They fired me. Approximately 20 of my coworkers were also fired. My coworkers, and especially Dayanita Bautista, who is here present, a woman of a lot of strength and courage, she fought inside of the plant so that I would be returned to my job.
Yo viajé a Suecia para hablar con la prensa sobre lo que estaba pasando en New Jersey. La prensa sueca y sus uniones estaban en shock. Y mi historia fue publicada en las primeras páginas de los periódicos.
I traveled to Sweden to talk to their press about what was going on here in New Jersey. The Swedish press and the Swedish unions were in shock. My story was published on the front page of their newspapers. Because of the negative publicity that H&M received in Sweden, they decided to offer us our jobs again. And they later decided to honor the results of a second card check agreement. In March of 2004, our decision to have a union was confirmed. And last month, we won our first contract. This includes benefits for part-time workers, pay increases, health insurance, we have a pension, we have vacation days, we have personal days, and we have a voice in our work.
Aunque estoy feliz de que H&M finalmente se puso de acuerdo en honrar nuestra decisión y negociar con buena fe, yo creo que no debí de ser despedida por haber participado.
Even though I'm happy that H&M decided to honor our decision and negotiate in good faith, I don't think I should have had to been fired for participating in union activities in order for them to recognize the union. And I also don't think that I should have had to fly all the way to Sweden to embarrass them so that they would be fair with us. All of the workers in this country have a right to form a union. And those companies that respect workers' rights to have unions in their own countries should not be permitted to violate our labor laws here in the United States. I urge you, I implore you to support workers who are in the same fight that I fought. And I urge you to fight in Congress for a just process that will enforce our rights.
Y derechos humanos.
Our legal rights and our human rights.
Y tener una voz en el trabajo.
And to have a voice in our job. Thank you very much.
Thank you so very much, Ms. Acosta. We are delighted with your victory, but we are appalled you had to leave your own country to achieve it. And we want to make sure that people don't have to leave this country to achieve that justice in the future.
You've been listening to a congressional forum on the Employee Free Choice Act. Well, the AFL-CIO has recently decided to spend more money on political work and rebate millions to its international unions to organize workers. We're joined by Stuart Acuff, organizing director of the AFL-CIO, to discuss these issues. Stuart Acuff has been a community and labor organizer for 25 years. Why don't we begin by, for example, the examples we've looked at of workers getting fired, of businesses moving away, of intimidation when trying to form a union. How widespread are these abuses? And welcome to WBAI's Building Bridges.
Thanks. It's good to be with you. These examples of workers being intimidated and otherwise abused by employers for trying to form unions and other related union activity are much, much too widespread. In fact, it's a common part of corporate culture in America today. The National Labor Relations Board, own conservative figures, will show you that 20,000 workers in America every year are victimized, fired, and otherwise retaliated against for trying to form a union or related union activities. Kate Bronfenbrenner at Cornell has done the research which shows the length and the depth to which employers will go to fail to honor workers' rights and to do anything that they can to keep workers from building their own worker power.
One of the tactics that the AFL-CIO and the unions are trying on, there have been pushes in the past, and there's a new push to enact a reform of the labor laws called the Employee Free Choice Act. Tell us about what that would do and what the possibility of enacting such a piece of legislation while the Republicans are still in control of the Congress.
Well, first, let me explain what happens when workers try to form a union. Employers can delay the process. They can intimidate workers. They fire workers, and there's very little penalty for firing workers who try to form a union, threaten workers, threaten to close a facility, on, and drag out the process for weeks and even months at a time. So this bill would do three things. One, it would say that workers could form a union by signing a card. More than 50% at a given work site sign a card or a petition saying that they want to form a union, and that would be recognized, and they would be certified as a union. We generally call that card check, and that's being used more and more. In fact, in 1935, when the National Labor Relations Act was originally passed, that was the most common way that workers had to declare their desire to form a union. So that's the first thing the Employee Free Choice Act would do. The second thing the Employee Free Choice Act would do is create real penalties for employers who violate the law, triple damage penalties when you fire or suspend somebody for union activity. Allow unions for the first time in the history of this country to go to court and get an injunction for employer abuse. Well, of course, employers have been able to enjoin unions from the beginning. And then the last thing the Employee Free Choice Act would do is provide for mandatory mediation and even arbitration at the end of the first year after workers have formed a union to keep employers from avoiding signing a union contract. You can't get it done between the union and the employer. After a year of trying, okay, then we'll mediate and then arbitrate it. The bill would go a long way towards restoring the fundamental freedom of workers in America to form unions and bargain collectively. Now, it wouldn't clear up every problem and every abuse, but it would go a long way towards giving those 57 million workers in polling who say they would form a union today if given a chance, that chance. When the bill was first introduced in November of 2003, in that Congress, we got 208 co-sponsors in the House, just 10 shy of a majority, and 37 co-sponsors in the Senate. Today, we had to reintroduce it, new Congress, so we reintroduced it in April of this year. We have almost 200 co-sponsors in the House and 38 co-sponsors in the Senate. So we are building support. Now, even if we could get this bill passed with a Republican-controlled Congress, George Bush will never sign it. But we cannot wait till the time is right, because if we wait, the time will never be right. We have to use this time that we have to broaden the constituency of support to restore the right to organize, deepen the constituency of support, and build as close as we can to a movement of workers, both union and non-union, which understands that so much of what's ailing the country is directly tied to the suppression of worker power, is directly tied to trying to eliminate or at least greatly cut back on worker power by stopping workers from forming unions.
We're speaking with Stuart Acuff, Organizing Director of the AFL-CIO, and since you mentioned worker power, what about building movements where workers are empowered? It doesn't seem that either Service Employees International Union or the AFL-CIO are really speaking about movement building, for example, the involvement of members such as the ones we heard earlier who were testifying from the New Jersey Town Hall meeting to change the labor law. What's that process about? What's happening?
Well, I agree with you that we're not talking enough about building mass movement. The truth of the matter is the fundamental source of power for this labor movement or any labor movement in the country is workers united and in motion. That is our fundamental source of power, and I think that's where we ought to be focused, and John Sweeney believes that as well. The truth of the matter is that from September of 2003 through the election, we had the largest period of mobilization over 18 months in decades. 100,000 people in September and October of 2003 participating in the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride. We had 20,000 union workers marching and protesting the FTAA summit in Miami. Just 3 weeks later, December 10th, International Human Rights Day, 40,000 workers across America demonstrated to change the labor laws and to enact the Employee Free Choice Act. Then we had 500,000 union volunteers engaged in the election process. So we actually do believe in mobilization. We believe in it greatly. Frankly, this debate has been way too much about structure and way too much focused internally and not nearly enough focused externally. And we haven't been talking to unorganized workers enough. We've been much too consumed with our internal business and not nearly externally focused enough. I think when we get past this convention, where President Sweeney will be reelected, you'll see the external focus again. But your point is well taken. We don't know, none of us know how to create movement or movement would have been created. But we do know elements of movement. We know that there's got to be a degree of creativity. We know that there's got to be room for spontaneity, for people to act on their own. We know that we have to create movement. We have to be willing to take chances and take risks. And frankly, facing the worst assault that we've faced in 80 years, since I would argue since the Palmer raids of 1919, the most right-wing government that our country's had in modern history in at least 70 years, that we have to be willing to do those things that can energize movement, that have the potential to generate and initiate movement. I will say this, that today Kevin went to Pittsburgh and testified at a great hearing in downtown Pittsburgh. 350 people attended this hearing, members of Congress, elected officials from up and down the ladder attended the Congress. That CWA, the Communication Workers of America, this union that along with the electrical workers is fighting Comcast, has said exactly what you said, that in fact, we not only have to work this bill in traditional ways, but we have to mobilize our members, our rank and file, to be willing to fight for this change and other changes. And of course, there are many other changes. And the truth of the matter is that I think if you look at when the labor movement grows, if you look at when workers take steps forward, when you can really see changes and improvements in quality of lives, when workers have a chance to lift their kids out of poverty, it's not done in isolation. It doesn't happen in isolation. It happens in the context and in the midst of a broad, strong, vibrant, progressive movement. And so that's why the AFL-CIO is not just talking about this legislation. Indeed, we are. It's a huge priority. We've got to someday see it passed. But we're also talking about saving Social Security. We're talking about saving the private pension program. We're talking about a fight to restore health care in this country and to end the stagnancy of our wages. But you can't separate the health and vitality of a working people's movement from a broader social struggle.
Stuart, certainly the answer is not just bringing masses of people together for a one-shot deal, if you will, but I can't help but think that next year there's going to be a millions more demonstration that is being presided over or stimulated by the Minister Louis Farrakhan. There are many other people that are involved in the effort. I keep thinking about Medicaid and Social Security and the election process and the Supreme Court process, which has many employment-based issues, and wonder why the labor movement is not calling out its masses of workers to present a physical presence in opposition to the backwardness of the Bush administration and the policies that stem from it, including these policies that are antithetical to workers mm-hmm. being able to organize unions. Mm-hmm. It would create a kind of, at least a pizzazz, an interest, a visibility in the consumer market as well of workers and worker power in all its physical glory, in all its numerosity.
Well, I mean, you make a good point. One thing, one of the questions, the strategic or tactical questions we struggle with, if you will, is do you focus that kind of power just on Washington, or do you demonstrate that kind of power across the country where more workers can actually participate? And as I said a while ago when I went through the litany of 18 months of mobilization across a wide spectrum of economic issues, we had decided at that time to spread the mobilizations, if you will, across the country. And of course, last year we put an awful lot of focus again on the elections because we understood how dangerous George Bush is. That there was a fundamental difference. Maybe it wasn't enough difference for us, and maybe we would have wanted more difference, but there was a fundamental difference between the agenda of the radical right-wing Republicans and the Democrats. As I say, after this election, we will look at again, at ways to mobilize to demonstrate a worker power across the country. And we do know that this year, again, on December 10th, International Human Rights Day, there will be major mobilizations all over the country to support this legislation we've been talking about and to support fundamental worker rights in the country. And then as other occasions come along, as other occasions come up, as there are other opportunities, we'll be looking at that as well. I can tell you that thousands of federal workers are mobilized from all over the country are mobilizing in Washington, D.C. to say no to the Bush administration's efforts to destroy collective bargaining in the federal workplace. They've now targeted 1 million federal workers to strip of collective bargaining rights. And so the mobilizations, the movement, the actions, the demonstrations, that is all critical to our future. And as I said earlier, I believe that the unfortunate part of this debate is we've talked too much about structure and too much to ourselves and not enough about movement and not enough to the rest of the country.
Time is running short, and it perhaps deserves a longer response, but a lot of these mobilizations that we see, at least in this area, are very small demonstrations set up for the press, which really don't involve a lot of workers. It seems as if this is what the AFL-CIO wants, the Central Labor Councils aren't instituting this.
Well, that certainly wasn't the case with the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride, where I think 50,000 people joined together in New York City. And it wasn't the case on December 10th of 2003 when I think 2,000 people were at the National Labor Relations Board headquarters. It wasn't the case.
Although, Stuart, I have to say that there really didn't appear to be any. We were at the Freedom Ride, and there were about 40,000 people, and there really wasn't anything that was a follow-up. There was nothing for the people who gathered there to do.
Look, we may be vulnerable on the question of whether or not there was adequate follow-up. I would argue that there's been a lot of follow-up, particularly in the Congress, but 40,000 people is a whole lot of people, and the Freedom Ride consumed 6 weeks between September and October of that year and covered the length and breadth of this nation. It was a huge mobilization. So, and then, you know, the question of small demonstrations wasn't the case when I was in New York in May when the graduate workers went on strike at Columbia, and we had a huge rally at Columbia and a march down Broadway involving higher education workers from all over New York City.
You know, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. We certainly do grant that there have been organizing efforts. There need to be absolutely more, and the workers need to assume their power, and we need a powerful, strong, organized workers' movement in this country to assume the wealth that it created. We've been speaking with Stuart Acuff, Organizing Director of the AFL-CIO, and we thank you very much for spending time with us.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
This has been a Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report special. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.